And if the world can understand how to walk in someone else's shoes just for a little while, I fundamentally believe the world would be a better place.
What's up, y'all? This is me here, Michael Franti, and welcome to the Stay Human podcast. And I have a super, super guest here today, somebody who is one of my favorite people in the whole world because he's a visionary. And I can't say that about a lot of people, but he is a true visionary as an entrepreneur, as a fashion icon, as a musician himself. And also he's now leading as the CEO of just one of the most incredible heritage brands in the world, Gibson Guitars. Our guest today is JC Curley. What's up, JC?
Hey, Michael. Great to see you, man. And just want to say the energy that you and the whole, you know, Soul Rocket Tribe are putting out through this sort of obstacle course that we've been on, from your live streams to your podcast. Just amazing. And so just great to connect. And thanks for having me on.
Thanks, man. It's always a treat just to be in your presence. And I want to hear first a little bit about, just so people know who you are and what you do, but then I want to get into like where you came from and how you grew up and how you came to be the person that you are today. So maybe just give a little bit of overview of like your professional career so people know who we're talking to here.
Yeah, well basically, you know, the old adage, like if you pursue your passions long enough, good things might happen. And, you know, when I was a kid, I loved M&Ms, and my first, apart from picking blueberries for money as a kid, but my first sort of real job was at M&M Mars. And I just loved the whole notion of, hey, man, I could work in a candy company, and did some really cool things there. I was part of the team that kind of convinced the big company at the time to kind of go, hey, man, what if we sponsored the Olympics with Snickers and took it global? And it's a moment where people come together, and Snickers is the ultimate energy bar for athletes. This was, by the way, let me date stamp this, you know, early 90s, 92. And Snickers said, yeah, let's do this. So I was right then I realized if you could dream big, but back it up with a bit of an idea. And so there I was running the Olympic program, part of the team for M&M Mars and Snickers. And I realized, wow. When I went to the Winter Olympics, I ran into these cool guys at Salomon, you know, the ski company and that. And then I did some partnerships with them and their athletes. And a few months later, they called and said, hey, JC, why don't you come work at Salomon? And I'm like, okay. And then so next thing I knew, I found myself in France and in talking to the Salomon guys. And that went amazing. And we started talking about how do you go from just the share of skis to the share of the mountain, and what does it look like? And then I ended up being the CEO of Salomon in North America. And then, so followed that passion. And then I really was intrigued by this whole entrepreneurial movement happening on the West Coast. And this guy invented this crazy shoe called a Keen shoe. And next thing you know, I find myself the CEO of Keen Footwear, this entrepreneurial startup with, it's kind of like Doc and Back to the Future. And all of a sudden I find myself in this crazy scene where I'm a CEO of a company that's growing up so fast, but we were doing amazing things and we didn't know any better. And we were harnessing social media and we were building factories in the US in Portland, Oregon. And that's against the big giants like the Nikes, who are amazing brands too. And so good folks at Levi's called and said, hey, if you can be an entrepreneur and a pioneer and a CEO of sports, why don't you come and help us out and rebuild Levi's? And I remember that moment in 2012. And I think that's just before I met you, and went down to the Bay Area and I said, hey, Levi's, you got to act like a 140-year-old startup, like make the future matter more. And next thing you know, they said, well, how do we do that? I said, well, you know, it's basically like leveraging your iconic past, but you got to innovate in the future. And they said, well, come help us do that. I said, well, what does that mean? They said, come be the president of Levi's. So I did that. And as you know, we did some pretty cool things there around trying to find the centers of culture for Levi's. It wasn't just about being a jeans company. It was about being in the center of culture and imagining not share of jeans, but what's the share of people's closet and their mind share around fashion and what they want to do. And yes, you can wear other jeans, but we said people live in their Levi's. So we did the Levi's Stadium deal, and the good folks at Gibson called and said, hey, JC, would you consider being on our board? And this was at a time when Gibson was going through a real challenging time. And I met all the folks who were trying to put it all back together again. At the end, they said, why don't you just come and run this and be the CEO? And Levi's was going great. And, you know, the Bay Area and San Francisco is beautiful. And this was Nashville, and this was a whole nother industry. And then I asked myself, you know, not why would I? It's like, why wouldn't I do this? And then here I am 2 years later, rebuilding Gibson. And I couldn't be more proud of what we're doing here. And the city of Nashville is Music City, USA. And here we are less than 2 years out of a very challenging situation for Gibson. We're rebuilding the iconic brand again, but we're engaging with our artists, with all the guitar dealers and the music community. And the future looks bright. So that's my awesome. Professional journey.
That's your professional thing in a nutshell. You're hired, by the way.
Yeah, awesome. Thanks.
You're the new CEO of Stay Human Podcast.
Yeah, I love it. But I do want to be clear, Michael. I just want to be clear too that like I don't hop around, man. I spent 6-7 years in each one of those places. I mean, that's a rapid run, but that was, you know, over 20-25 years. And so I actually start every, as you know me, I start every position with the right balance, I think, passion and professionalism and this whole notion of perseverance. And I act like I'm going to be there forever because that's how my mother taught me. Like when you move to a new community, act like you're going to be there forever. Even if you know you might move in a few years, engage.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's dive in because there's something that you said that I think is really important. And I think it kind of sums up a lot of who you are as a person, which is you have big ideas that can be backed up, you know, big ideas that can be backed up. And, you know, not everybody has that mindset. You know, a lot of people think small, you know, and they have a hard time getting out of their box. A lot of people have huge ideas, but they just totally impractical. And you just mentioned your mom of thinking always like in the long term. So how is it that you know, let's talk about like when you grew up, what was the house like that you grew up in? What was like your earliest memory as a kid?
Earliest was probably left best for another show. Cause I guess, you know, I have a identical twin brother and we were fortunately when we were growing up, I'm James Curley, he's John Curley. So in a weird way, we're kind of both JCs, but he was always John the Bad. So I was nicknamed James the Good. So when you got that as a handle, you could get away with a lot, but, you know, I grew up in a really, really interesting dynamic. And I know your story and it's amazing, but my dad was a Navy helicopter pilot and, you know, he was Canadian Navy, but he was asked to come down in the early 60s to work with the U.S. Navy in the Cuban Missile Crisis. And he flew off the USS Intrepid in 63, 64. And that was a very serious mission. It was a very serious time, but he was literally a Top Gun pilot doing low level amazing things with a helicopter. They said, okay, we need his specialization on the Intrepid. So, and apart from just being an amazing pilot, he's a really cool guy. And so when his secondment finished with the U.S. Navy, they said, hey, you know, time to head back. And someone came up and said, not so fast. Why don't you stick around Norfolk here? We got a few other ideas for you in Virginia. And that was the time when some of the NASA programs, so he was involved with, you know, the helicopter that picks up the astronauts, and he was brought in to do all these like specialized helicopter projects. And so I was actually born in Virginia, and I love the fact that, you know, as an international citizen, you start your journey in a place that really wasn't going to be my home. And then I have a younger sister, a twin brother, older brother, and then we moved back to Canada. And what I remember is that growing up, you got a father who's this Navy helicopter pilot that was, you know, really a badass and ended up being a general and the whole thing. And then you got this mother who's this amazing free spirit from Nova Scotia, Canada. And their common denominator, so one of my first memories was them, the serious, you know, pilot and the free-spirited mom, but their common denominator was music. And my mom played her guitar, her Epiphone guitar, which she's had all her life, which was probably the same one that John Lennon and McCartney were rocking in the 60s. So my mom was that. My dad played banjo and they would get together. And after a few drinks, all of a sudden the Curley home would go from this kind of, you know, interesting to a really interesting musical home. And then, and on it would go. And so, and then we moved around. I've lived in 5 different countries and my dad would say, hey, it's time to go on a new adventure, kids. And we would move to a new place. And so for instance, when we'd moved to Holland when we were just going into high school, and my mom and dad, they would make us at the time. My mom would make blueberry muffins. My dad would get a 24 pack of Labatt's blue beer and say, okay, let's go meet the neighbors. And we were like, really? Come on. And then there we were giving blueberry muffins and Labatt's beer to all the neighbors. And my mom's like, well, you never know. We might be here forever and let's engage in the community. She would learn Dutch and we would speak the language. We never lived in the expat community. We're always miles outside because we wanted to engage in the community. And then my dad, was known as this guy who took what he did really seriously, but he didn't take himself too serious, which I just love that. And he was an amazing dad who would equally engage, but also make sure that every adventure, we got the most out of it. So I went to 11 different schools, 5 different countries. One of my early memories, which I think is really, you know, it's an interesting dynamic looking back now, we moved to Virginia, back to Virginia when I was in second grade. And I went to my local school in Alexandria, Virginia, and I walked in and there were 2 white kids, me and Rachel, and all black kids. And it was the year in the 70s when they did the interracial busing in Virginia and Washington, D.C. And my parents just said, look, you're going to go to the school that's near us. And that's the school. And so fast forward 20, 30 years later, when people talk about diversity and inclusion, well, my mom brought us up to be inclusive. My dad, through the nature of where we traveled, we were always in diversity dynamics. And so we grew up with that. So today, when people talk about it in this sort of sometimes a contrived prescriptive way, I look at it as a very natural evolution of my experience. And when people talk diversity and inclusion, I kind of say, well, I grew up in that, so that's all I know. I don't know what it's not like to be in a diverse dynamic or what is not inclusive mean. I don't know what it is. So, I mean, that's some of my early memories between music and looking at different cultures.
What was the coolest thing about a change? Like, if you could think of one time when you moved from one city to the next, what was the coolest thing about it? And then what was the most challenging part? Like, if you could think of when you're like 13, pimply face kid, going through puberty, like, and then you got to show up at this other place and you got to try to like make friends. You got to try to figure out what's the program there. And so what was the coolest part about it? And what was the, like, the suckiest part of it?
Well, I got a couple ones, and maybe it was that year in 1976 when literally I was the only white kid in my class, and I really embraced it. And I just thought it was, you know, just something special. And then that next year, the Canadian government said, hey, you know, just so we're clear, your kids have to learn French. So you need to go to a school that teaches French in Virginia. And like, okay, where's that? It's a private school. So we went from Maury Elementary, which was literally, I was in the hood in such a good young second grader way. You know, me and my brother, John, and my older brother, George, my sister, we just figured it out. And then the next year we were at this private school called Westminster, where the actual mascot name was the Westminster Abbeys. So awesome. I'm now an Abbey, you know? And the stark contrast between that public and private was like, all of a sudden, I'm learning Greek mythology and I was being taught Latin and we were looking at politics. This is now in the third grade. And again, the punchline isn't one was better or worse. It was just, you could see that education, culture, kid dynamic unfold live in a very real way from second to third grade. And then fast forward, I think one of the interesting ones was when I was in eighth grade and then we moved from Canada to Holland. And so, you know, Canada's relatively conservative, despite the fact that it's got sort of, you know, a liberal ethos. It's relatively conservative. And then you go to Holland as a 15-year-old. Well, guess what you can do at 15? You can drive a motorbike. I had a girlfriend, a Dutch girlfriend, who was taller than me. And there's no drinking age. So within 1 week, we were these eighth grade kids playing hockey in Canada. And 3 weeks later, me and my brothers have motorbikes, Dutch girlfriends, and mom and dad, this is my girlfriend, Tanya. I'm getting on my motorbike and we're going to the bar. And so this new, and the newfound freedom that gave us, right? I mean, but it was all there. And so you talk about, like, in America, you grow up in a sequenced way, you know, junior high, high school, and there's certain rites of passage that are obvious and understood and natural and accepted. And there's other ones and obstacle courses that you get on and you figure it out. In Holland, there's no drama. You just show up and like, hey, I got transportation, I've got a relationship, and I can engage in society as an adult. So we grew up really fast. And I think that was also part of just being agile and understanding that all the years of being the new kid actually can be an advantage if you look at it that way.
Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I really consider you to be, like I said, like a visionary thinker. Like, you're always thinking of other things, not just in the field that you're working in. I mean, we sit down together and we'll talk about sports, then we'll talk about technology, then we'll talk about politics, then we'll talk about fashion, then we'll talk about art. And we'll talk about what we're doing with our, as raising kids and in this crazy era that we're in right now. At what point did you start thinking like, maybe I'm just going to be an idea guy and start creating a career around that. Like, you talked to me about your first job at Mars. Mm-hmm. How did that happen? That you, first of all, that you just had the moxie, I guess is the word, to just go, hey, here's my idea. I mean, was that something you always felt comfortable sharing, or was it something you had to develop over time? Or?
Yeah. I mean, you never know. I mean, as you know, all your experiences kind of shape you. And I could go back to a memory when we were kids and our summer job was literally scooping blueberries. And I remember telling the story to a group of students. I said, you can learn everything you need to know about life scooping blueberries. And they're kind of like, okay, where's this guy going? Well, if you've ever had to scoop blueberries, it's not easy. And there's a very finite season. There's a lot of people trying to make some money picking a lot of berries, you know? So my brothers and I reluctantly, my mom signed us up. And so I remember this morning, the first morning, we were the first ones in the truck thinking, oh, let's get up early in the back of the pickup truck. We get there. We have no idea what to do. Everyone scrambles out, gets the good bucket, the good scoop. They get to the good area. And there's the Curly Boys last to the first day. And like, we got the crappy scoop, the small bucket, and we didn't even know where to go. So that night, I remember saying to my brothers, you know what? We got that all wrong. We got to be the last ones in the truck so we'd be the first ones out. And then we have to, as we get there, squint. And they're like, what do you mean squint? I said, squint at the fields. Wherever you see the most blue, that's where we got to go. And by the way, if you're first out, you get the biggest scoop and you can get two big buckets. So if you just think about that dynamic, like a little bit of organization of where to go, a bit of vision by squinting to see where the blue is, and then get the right tools to do the job. And that next day, we literally doubled our blueberry picking. And when you all of a sudden get your card punched and you go from making 10 bucks a day to 20 bucks a day, you think you're going backwards on day three? Hell no, we were making 30 bucks the next day. So that's a microcosm of how to think about there's organization, there's tools, there's vision, but you got to bring it together quickly for action. So fast forward, you know, one of my favorite stories about that was this whole notion of you know, at Salomon, it was literally a ski company. We made skis, boots, and bindings. And George Salomon, an amazing guy, was like, what could we be more? He was 85 years old. He goes, could Salomon be more? And I'm like, yeah, look at the mountain. Let's not look at share of ski. Let's look at the share of the mountain. And what happens on the mountain? You have people wearing apparel, and there's the safety aspect with helmets, and there's people snowboarding. And then when the snow melts, people want to trail run and hike. Well, fast forward 5 years later, we were into snowboarding, into apparel, into protective equipment, into cycling, Mavic cycling. We launched Salomon Hiking. So reimagining and rethinking about what success looks like shouldn't be defined by where you started. It's where you could take it. And then, you know the Levi's story. We talked about, you know, interesting, Levi's is the worldwide leader in jeans. It always has been. But it didn't lead in the minds of the lifestyle leadership. And so we said, let's look at the share of closet. Let's be a lifestyle leader, the leader of someone's style of their life, not just the worldwide leader in jeans. So having a bold vision, but then to your point, like you have to then back it up. What does that look like? And so fast forward to Gibson. I remember the first day I showed up with a piece of cardboard and just said, SOS. And it was SOS. Gibson was bankrupt. 2 years ago to this day, it was still bankrupt. Almost 2 years to the day, I walked into the cannery here in Nashville with a piece of cardboard. It said SOS. And I said, guys, this is the SOS call. It went out for real. And we're going to try to figure that out and save it. And I said, what does the new SOS stand for? And it's the share of sound. What are we going after? We're not going after share of guitars. We're trying to make amazing sound with artists, with our guitars, with live, with recorded. And what our guitars do is they provide sound. And if you think about it, Gibson has produced more sound as an instrument and as a brand than any other specific brand or instrument on earth. We've been creating and inspiring and shaping sound for 125 years. That's our mission going forward. So I flipped it from, you know, save our ship to share of sound. And all of a sudden it enabled the organization to say, we got a share of sound quest. So those are just some examples of how you change the landscape a little bit to go after what it is really worth going after.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Little tweaking in the thinking. And I think that's one of the great things that I've learned from you and that I've seen you do in so many ways with so many people is to be able to find those seeds of optimism. taking these challenges and turning them into incredible opportunities where other people would be like, yeah, let's save our ship. Well, maybe we should sell this off and see what we can get out of this and move on. But you're one of those people who has that ability to find the optimism and then to be able to bring it to other people and get them to buy into it, get them to get excited about it. You know, talk to me a little bit about that over the years. What are the things that you've done to try to like inspire your team, your army, like, let's get behind this and let's go.
Well, I'll tell you, this was a very real story. And the step from little Keen footwear, the toe protected sandal that could, you know, like it was like, there I was. And the Levi's team sort of asked me to join that. I remember on day one, and it was kind of dumb. I got to tell you, I mean, I've been in many situations, but showing up in San Francisco, California, as a kid who lived in other places was pretty, it was amazing, but it was also a little daunting. You know, it's Bay Area, it's San Francisco, it's Silicon Valley, it's the everything that you knew growing up. And there I was in it. And Levi's, I've worn Levi's all my life. And I'm like, am I really up for this? You know, like, what am I going to bring to Levi's that they haven't already done? So on, I think it was day one or two, I remember someone in the team said, oh, JC, by the way, we do this annual employee survey. And every year, this is what we do. And the last question we ask is, do you think at Levi Strauss & Company, our best days are behind us or ahead of us? And so first of all, I'm like, what company would ask that question? Like it spoke to me about the culture at the time, by the way, at the time.
Sounds like you're already packing it in right there. You know?
Yeah. And yeah. So, but the answer to that question was even more horrifying, was 73% of the team globally at Levi Strauss & Company in 2012 thought the best days were behind them. And so, yes, there's strategy and yes, there's denim leadership and you invented the blue jean. But if you have a culture that thinks the best days are behind them, like that's untenable. So my covert obsession was not only to turn that around and make it 75% think it's better. I wanted to make the question redundant. You don't have to ask this question because we're so future focused. And that's where we really started thinking about this notion of the 140-year-old startup. If you think about a startup, what does a startup desperately want? Funding. It desperately wants awareness. It wants to have a product or something, a solution that matters to people. And then it grows and it builds. And it's the entrepreneurial dream, right? A little idea, some money, a little hard work. And then and if you ask a startup like, hey, are your best days ahead of you or behind you? There is no behind for a startup. Like it's, if your best days are behind you, you don't survive. So this notion of a 140-year-old startup at Levi's, we then said, but if we could leverage the heritage and the iconic success and the generations of Levi's from the soldiers in World War II to cowboys, to the gold miners, to James Dean, to rock and roll, to fashion, to Woodstock, to everything we knew about Levi's, and then treat it like a startup, wouldn't that be the right culture to set? And so we, along with, you know, with the leadership team at Levi's, said, that's it. That's the cultural conditions for success, is being the 140-year-old startup. And what it does is it makes you think future. It makes you think about innovation. It makes you set conditions for success that you otherwise wouldn't have set if you didn't have that mode of being a 140-year-old startup. So guess what? Fast forward to Gibson, we're the 125-year-old startup. Leverage your iconic past, which is really iconic. I mean, if you think about Gibson, which we'll get into in a second, just that iconic contribution that Gibson's made. But my challenge to the team is, how can Gibson matter more in the future? And it's really mattered in the past, which is a great challenge for a team. So that's sort of that cultural, it's not about the strategy and the business and the profit and the growth. It's about the cultural dynamics. Once you set the cultural dynamics in motion, chances are the business and the brand go into motion.
Mm-hmm. You know, these days brands really have to think about what it is that they're, not just their, what they're making and selling, but what is it that they're giving to the community? And you just described some of it just in terms of the cultural, but also just what are things that companies can do to really plug in and be giving back, you know, rather than just being seen as takers, but they're being seen as givers in the community and actually doing the giving. So what are some of the things, I know you did a lot with that at Levi's, and maybe you could talk about that, but also what you guys are doing in Gibson.
Well, I mean, Levi's is, you know, it's such a well-respected, iconic brand. And let's face it, it's, you know, in the $5 billion of in Bay Area. And so you put Bay Area, which tends to be community-minded. I believe that, you know that, and it's an amazing community. And And yes, it's got its challenges, but the community tends to rise up every generation and figure it out. So that's one point. But when you come to a company that was, you know, technically bankrupt 2 years ago in Nashville, in Music City, USA, and I can say this, you know, now that, you know, I think people had always loved Gibson, the brand, but they really didn't like the company or what was happening to it. So in the last 2 years, we've kind of not only reimagined, but we've re-engaged. So I declared this triple down on Nashville. And so these are very real moves, and they weren't easy, by the way, but we had a factory in Memphis making our ES guitars. And I said, this just doesn't make sense to be, and Memphis is an awesome town. I mean, it's got this illustrious heritage of music, but from a business and brand point of view, if you've got a starting point that's called Nashville, it's synonymous with being called Music City, USA, then you want to triple down on that. So we moved one of our factories. We have two here in Nashville, and we have a factory in Bozeman, but I moved the Memphis factory to Nashville as a real statement of intention. We were out in the outside in not such a great part of town, way out in this place called Plus Park. The offices were just not conducive to actually being in this amazing creative industry. It was just a terrible place to work. And so we moved downtown in Cummins Station, this iconic brick building in the center of Nashville. And then we relaunched, it was called the Gibson Foundation, but it has lost its way. And it was just, it was whatever the previous leadership liked or supported, they supported. There was no philosophical backing to it. It was just giving out a few things, a few dollars here and a few guitars there. So we really reimagined the Gibson Foundation. We now call it Gibson Gives. And it's really about giving the gift of music one guitar at a time. And we had just a simple plan to give out 1,000 guitars in 1,000 days. And that was a year ago. We're supposed to be like 300 guitars into it. I think we're 938 guitars into it. And the head of the Gibson Gives said, JC, we need more guitars. I said, you got them. So those are real. When you say let's triple down on Nashville, we moved a factory back to Nashville. We put ourselves in the center of culture of Nashville. We actually relaunched Gibson Gives to the community. And now it's a fabric, you know, a part of the community. And it wasn't that long ago, although we think it was years ago. Do you remember the tornado hit just before COVID?
Yeah,
there was a tornado that ripped through right behind me here. And I remember waking up and going, holy shit, Nashville just had a real tornado. And this one image that caught my eye was a guitar, broken guitar in the rubble of someone's home. And I woke up and went to the team and said, you know what? A lot of musicians lost their guitar, whether they were professional, whether they loved their guitar, it was a part of their life. And I just put it out there, and it wasn't a big press release. I said, hey, let everyone know that JC says anyone who lost a guitar in their tornado, you come see us and we're going to give you a new guitar. It didn't matter what brand it was. It didn't matter how old it was. It didn't matter who you were. And we've given out and are in the process of giving out about 450, almost 500 guitars to tornado victims who lost their livelihood as a result of that. So there we are within 2 years rebuilding it, but real actions to your point, you know, moving factories, shifting offices, investing in our facilities. The day that COVID hit and we had to shut our factories down without any checking with our board or the CFO, I said, no one in our factories leave that factory until they get $1,000. By the way, no one knew how long this was going to go on. We had no idea. This was before the government even put any funding into it. I said, wow, we're shutting it down. We're putting $1,000 in everyone's hand. Every one of those crafts people deserve to have a little bridge. So I know there's move a factory, build a new office, give $1,000, set up the foundation. But these are real actions that all of a sudden the community is re-welcoming Gibson and saying, you're now back. You're part of the community. And we're glad that you're here, not only contributing to music through your amazing guitars, but to the community through the amazing energy and efforts.
That's awesome. I want to shift gears a little bit because I know you're a huge sports fan, as am I. And I want to know about how sports shaped your life. I mean, we have a similarity, which is that I grew up playing sports. I also grew up loving music. And I feel like the two are rarely talked about. You know, it's kind of like, oh, there's the jocks on this side and the artists on this side, and you can't be both. You know, for people who are listening to this show right now, I think that it's possible for everybody to express, you know, the full rainbow of their creativity, be it on an athletic field, be it as an entrepreneur, as an artist, as just somebody who's writing on their own or meditating or doing whatever they do with their body. Like, there's this full range of things. And so often we categorize them in these different places. But I know that sports has been a big influence in the person that you are in your work ethic, your team building. And I'd love to just hear a little bit about how, you know, you and John battled as a kid.
Yeah, coming up. And... right. Yeah. Well, I mean, let me start with this. I'm a guy who has to make choices about a lot of people. I mean, in terms of hiring them, or on the other end, and people don't fit the culture, you end up having to have tough decisions about people leaving. But one of my starting points, and I've probably literally gone through, I don't know if it's 10,000 resumes, and, you know, not just fancy people at the executive level. I tend at Gibson, I've interviewed every single person that's going to join our company because that culture matters. But you know what I do? I don't start from the top, Michael. I go to the bottom of the resume. What do people put on the bottom? Oh, a few things that they like. I was captain of this. I played guitar in a band, this. And that tends to get dismissed by a lot of people. And they want to know what school and what experience. I'm like, that's interesting. There's interesting experience. And I glance at that. But I go, if you were the captain of a sports team in high school, that wasn't because your parents got that for you. The coach didn't just say, hey, we like you better than the other kids. When you're deemed a captain of a team in high school, you are deemed that by your peers. The peers are usually the ones that say, you've earned the right to lead our team. And so, or if you're a musician and you played in a band and you did something, by definition, you were motivated and you put yourself out there. I mean, imagine those kids that are on the stage in high school where they know that they're not perfect and they're nervous, but they start playing that first song and people clap, and that feeling of like engagement, whether they're clapping for you because you're the quarterback that threw a touchdown, or you're a kid that threw your first lead guitar, or an amazing girl who sung her first song, her first Taylor Swift cover song in high school. There's a common denominator there that's around leadership, and you took the lead in something and you sort of influenced the dynamic around you. And the other common denominator is what a lot of people don't see is the amount of energy and effort and angst that goes into perfecting a song and playing live. Well, that same energy and angst and effort goes into an athlete preparing to go on a field. And I think that's one of those dynamics that can't be taught, is how do you have this self-motivation to always be making progress in the pursuit of perfection. No one expects you to be perfect. I don't expect my team to be perfect, but I expect them to make progress towards a goal. And so I think that's a great common denominator, is the amount of energy and effort. And I said the angst, but also the rewards that you get when you actually, you know, you make it look easy. And, you know, I've seen you many times live and people go, oh my God, Michael's so amazing. He's so spontaneous and he does what he does. And then, and I just join him and go, yeah, man, he's just awesome. And he's an awesome human, and the spirit shines on the stage, but it shines equally bright off the stage. And yet I know how much energy and effort you put into what you do, but people don't need to know that. They just need to see the result of that and then work in reverse order and say, kids, a little hard work, a little effort, a little motivation. But when you feel the energy of what comes back to you, I've seen you get energy. You think you're energizing the crowd, but the crowd is energizing you. And that, whether that's the fans and the 49ers, or whether that's a high school game, or whether that's your first concert, when you get that interaction, fan interaction two way, it's really special. And I think that's a really common denominator.
That really, you know, that makes my hair stand up on end, because that's exactly how I feel when I perform. It's that interplay. It's not just me performing for you, but there's this exchange of energy. And I can just imagine 2 years ago, you walking into Gibson and people there going, hey man, we've been here a while. And now there's another guy coming in. Who's this joker? You know, and then you pick up the guitar and play. Yeah. What did that mean? At Gibson, you actually make instruments, and you're a player.
Yeah, well, I gotta tell you, that was daunting. And you've seen me play a little bit, and I'm no professional, but I'm so passionate about it, you know that. And so just the opportunity to tie, you know, 25 years of experience and professionalism and strategy and vision and big Levi's and small entrepreneurial Keen and sports. And so then all of a sudden, I gotta tell you, it was my most challenging entry point, because there I was. It's not like being the CEO of a company. It's like, this is like, I felt like it's a noble cause. It was like Braveheart. You know, you show up and like everyone's looking at you like, okay, Mr. California, Levi's, did all that. This is Nashville. This is Gibson. And this one is for real. Not that Levi's wasn't, but like, this is a noble cause, man. And you have no choice but to engage. And so the passion side of me was already there. The professional side I relied on, but I got to tell you, like, the moment when I could actually pick up like a Gibson guitar, which I had a few before, and say like, this is going to be my livelihood, not like yours where you get to do these amazing things. But my livelihood was I could literally perfectly mesh my professional experience with my personal passion and hopefully make a difference. And I remember early on, I was invited to this place called the Music Loft, and it's a place on 2nd and Broadway where all the musicians hang out. It's an invite only thing. And they said, hey, and I got there and then someone said, hey, to everyone, this is JC, he's the new CEO of Gibson. And I was like, oh, he's the guy. And it was one of those like, okay, kind of like you said, it was like the courtesy Nashville. It wasn't like cheers and high fives. It was like, oh, okay. Cause they had this dark side, long history, a lot of baggage with Gibson. Like, okay, is this another guy that's just going to come and perpetuate the Gibson debacle of the past? And so, you know, there's a little bit of, oh, welcome. And then the party kind of went on, and it's a music loft with musicians and they play. So then they get up and they start playing. It's one of those things where everyone can get up. And then this big guy gets up, Tim McGraw's guitar player. He plays guitar on The Voice, amazing guy. He says, JC, welcome, man. It's been a long time, and it's a long time coming, and we hope. And he kind of dared me. He goes, we just hope you're all that, man, because we heard about you, and Gibson deserves the best, and we just hope that you give it the best, man, because we need it. I'm like, I just kind of waved and said, yeah, that's going to be what I'm going to try. And he goes, and we heard you play. And I'm like, yeah. He goes, why don't you come up here and play? You don't, in Nashville, you don't say no, you know? So you don't be like, oh no. So I just got up there, grabbed the guitar, started playing. And all of a sudden we did a 10-minute version of, give me the beat, boys, and free my soul. What I want. Yeah. And I'm like, it's Drift Away. And so all of a sudden I just start playing that. And I started with the chorus, not the verse, just to get it going. And this guy's looking at me like, okay. And then all of a sudden people came up and singing, and someone jumps on the piano, and then different people came in for different verses. And we did a 10-minute version of Drift Away. And I just remember that night, like you said, like I was drawing so much energy going, holy shit, I'm in Nashville playing a Gibson guitar, and I get to go to work the next day to make Gibson the company, the iconic company that it should be. And these guys are thanking me not only for that, but they're saying, JC, you're the real deal, man. You got up and you know what? You got the authentic ability to actually not just say what you're going to do, but play what you're going to do. And so that was my sort of entry point in Nashville and for Gibson. And from that moment on, I'm like, okay, this is absolutely a noble cause.
That's awesome. I can totally picture being there with you because I've been there with you on stage. And I love it.
Well, and trust me, I never take those moments for granted, man. Some of the special times in my life too, being able to kind of look over and just see you going like, man, I don't know where this is going, JC, but it's a lot of fun. So I never take those moments for granted either.
Nice, nice. You know, the final question I have for you is about staying human. And, you know, what you described for me right there and what you've done at all the different brands that you've worked with is that you've brought the humanity in it, you know, instead of it making it be about M&Ms, let's make it about the Olympics, which is this international pursuit of people coming together to celebrate the best of athletics. And same thing at Salomon. It's not just about, oh, we make these technical bindings and here's the XJ11 model this year next year with XJ21 model. But it's about like, what do you do on the mountain? Like, what does your soul get from the mountain? The same thing with Levi's. It's not just this jeans you wear. It's like, it's this life, this so many touch points in our life of, you know, Kurt Cobain wearing Levi's and, you know, an astronaut wearing Levi's and they're training. There's so many different things, you know, and how we incorporated that into our lives. And now you're doing the same thing with the embodiment of music. And I really, just from what you described, Gibson isn't really selling guitars. They're selling that feeling that a kid has the first time when they're able to go between a G chord and a D chord and like sing this song that they've heard on the radio. And now they're like living it. They're breathing the music. And now there's this dream that's created of how can I share this with other people? And, you know, when you're talking before about share of
sound.
Share of sound. Yeah. I was thinking like share our sound. It's like, how do we share this sound with one another? And we're connecting with each other through music. And talk to me about what it means for you to be human and how you stay human, and then how you bring in that to Gibson.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, we talked about it a little bit, and I know your story for sure. And I mean, you reflect on that often. And I think it's all those experiences through life, and some of it's an obstacle course. And, you know, it's almost as simple as how can a human turn the obstacle course of life, which we all get faced with, and how do you just literally turn the obstacle course of life into an opportunity course? And I know that sounds like a cliche, and I know that as a guy who's been around the world and done a few things, I can say that now, but I really believe that. And I think there's kind of two types of people in the world. There's either the victims who blame everyone and everything, and it's never their fault, and life isn't fair. And sometimes, by the way, it isn't fair and it's a tragedy. But like, and then there's the victors, which say, you know what, I'm going to just turn this obstacle course into an opportunity course, and I'm going to get stronger as a result of it. And I think part of staying human is not just about center pointing in between those two. I think it's about understanding that we're all going to go through obstacles, and whether those personal or professional, and I've had my share. And at the same time, I see every obstacle as an opportunity to actually pivot, intersect, do something different, and learn from it. And so the notion of staying human is also around your mindset. And I think you know me well enough. I think what most people, what almost confuses people about me, and I kind of warn people when I'd start a new company, is, hey, let me just tell everyone, I don't take myself too serious. And everyone knows I love to have fun. I love to play music. I love to engage with people. But I take my role as a leader of a company, as a brand, and of the team really serious. I mean, the future of Gibson is literally in my hands. It's on my shoulders. It's in my head. It's in my heart. And so I take that really seriously. And I think as a human, you should absolutely be able to define what you take serious. And when you say that, you have to back it up with your actions and your experience, but don't take yourself too serious. And there's nothing worse than someone who takes themselves too serious, but they don't take what they do serious. And then all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute, where does that get you? So it's really interesting what's happening during this COVID. I've learned a lot of lessons in this COVID dynamic. When it first hit, we had this board meeting, and we have an amazing board and a very supportive board. But they said, JC, we should look at all these different scenarios and look at different things. I'm like, yeah, we should. And I said, but who's been here before? Like, who's been in this situation? And we realized as a board, none of us. And by the way, I have a board that's got experience from every corner of every issue and brand and business you've ever seen, but none of us have been here. So you talk about, we're on an obstacle course, and we said, how do we turn this into an opportunity course? Where we said, well, we don't know where the future is going. Let's protect our teams first and foremost. And we put this thing called Operation Safer. And it was basically the safety action plan for employees returning. So we put all the protocol in place. We gave every worker in the factory $1,000. We put this protocol in place. So then we said, let's go Operation Gibson Agility Plan, which basically said, lock down the business on only the essentials of what we need to do. And let's make some more guitars and let's try to figure it out. This was not like 10 years ago. This was 4 months ago. Our factories were shut. And then all of a sudden, as we saw opportunity, we unleashed it. We reopened our factories. They were deemed essential business because it's Nashville, Music City. And all of a sudden we realized we were making the real pivot. And if you remember Maslow's hierarchy of needs, that's what it taught us. If you think about in March and April, you know what people were worried about?
Toilet paper.
Toilet paper. Am I going to have a job? And can I pay my bills? And am I going to be safe? Should I wear a mask? Shouldn't I? Should I go out? Shouldn't I? Well, all of a sudden over time, accelerated time, people were self-actualizing, like, okay, I feel a little safer because my, you know, I'm protected. I've got a little more time. What can I do with this? Man, I'm going to learn an instrument. I'm going to get all my photos off my iPhone and put them in an album. I'm going to learn to cook. I'm going to self-actualize into things that I want to do. So part of staying human, I think, is I really think Maslow was onto something. Like, once your basic needs are taken care of, shelter, food, and protection and all that, then you try to do a few things, then you truly can self-actualize as a human. And it's an amazing experience when you go through that in an accelerated period of time like we did. We went from very concerned to still there's clear concerns in the world, but people are going, well, when it gets back to normal, I'm like, there is no back to normal. There's going to be a new normal, and let's make the positive pivot towards it. And giving people not just hope as your strategy, but giving people an action orientation to turn that obstacle course into an opportunity course. And I think that's got to be all underpinned, which is a whole nother topic. If there's one word the world needs now, and you and I have talked about this, Michael, it's empathy. And I really mean this, and it sounds so cliche, so I want this to come across the right way. People say, oh, you're the CEO. Yeah, I'm the chief empathy officer right now. I have to empathize with my community, with my team, with my family, who I haven't seen for a while, with my board of directors and our owners, with artists. I want to empathize with them. I know your story. Oh, where were you supposed to be 4 months ago? On an amazing tour with Kenny Chesney and that whole deal. And all of a sudden, that just came to an abrupt halt. So what did you do? You turned your obstacle course into an opportunity course. And what you've been doing, where you've been doing it, and how you've been engaging with your fans is truly inspirational. So you're living proof of obstacle to opportunity. I think I've done a few things. And the one thing amongst many we have in common is we have for real empathy that we apply into everyone around us. And when you can do that, and if the world can understand how to walk in someone else's shoes just for a little while, I fundamentally believe the world would be a better place.
I agree. That's how we stay human. That's how we hold on to our humanity, yeah, to be able to see it in others. So, hey man, this has been awesome to talk to you. And where can folks find you? I know you're not really a social media guy, no, but if they come to Nashville, they can probably come to the new building there, right? And
well, I'll tell you what, and this is like, so you want a live exclusive? This is, yeah, a live exclusive that has not gone public, but I'll give it to you. We are literally in the final stages of building out. Certainly, we have our headquarters in Nashville, but in that building, there's this amazing space on the ground floor, and we're creating the Gibson experience there. It's the Gibson Garage, and essentially what it's going to be is an 8,000, almost 10,000 square foot live experience. It's going to be guitars, custom shop, acoustic. We're going to have our Gibson brand, our Epiphone, our Kramer, all that stuff there. We're going to have our artist relations. So you might be in there, and all of a sudden the stage, Michael Frondi just walks out from the picking up his guitar, and he walks on the stage and he's playing live, and all of a sudden there's 500 people in there, and the police are like, what's going on at the Gibson Garage? We're like, Bronte's playing, you know? So that opens up in a couple months, and we haven't announced it yet, but it's going to be an amazing experience here in Nashville. And it's a place where people can create the guitar of their dreams. They can listen to the creators in terms of music. We're going to live stream all of that. So you'll find me at the Gibson Garage in a few months, and I'll be hanging out there. How's that?
That's awesome. All right, JC, thanks a lot for joining us on the Stay Human podcast. And man, it's always inspiring to talk to you. And I just can't wait to see what the next decade brings for Gibson.